Galatians chapter 2, verse 11 to the first part of verse 14, the seventh talk in a series on Galatians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 21, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 3, Translation, Installment 2, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we've been looking at the book of Galatians. The book of Galatians is written to a group of people in what today is south coast of Turkey. At the time, Gentiles had become believers. After Paul had established those communities in that region, a group of Jews from Jerusalem, in all likelihood, made their way up church after church after church in the Galatian area and told them that they weren't getting the straight scoop and they weren't getting the full story. Paul had left some important stuff out. They needed to obey the commandments, the instructions in the Mosaic covenant if they were going to be real, authentic, bona fide disciples of Jesus. And Paul has got wind of that back in Antioch in Syria, and so he writes this letter in response to this brewing controversy among the Galatians. He opens it up with some preliminary remarks. His first statement, the first point that he makes, is that he got his understanding of the gospel directly from God. His did not come by way of any man. He got it directly from God. It was a complicated process, and we've been talking about that a little bit. But as far as Paul is concerned, with all the complications, nonetheless, he considers his understanding to have been derived from God himself, and therefore he is, he's not going to yield to any man in their understanding of the gospel. Then he goes on in the next section, and that's the part that we're still exploring. He goes in the next section to say, and furthermore, this message that I got directly from God, it is completely compatible, completely congruent with what the apostles teach. And he establishes that in a couple of ways. And in the first case, he talks about a trip that he took to Jerusalem where he was there to bring relief for a famine in Jerusalem. But while he was there, he took the opportunity to sit down with John, Peter, and James kind of in private and go over what he understood the gospel and its implications to be to check it out. Are we on the same page? Are we not on the same page? And what they concluded is we're completely on the same page. We think you've got it exactly right. And that's what we looked at last week. Now, in the section we're going to look at this week, he's still trying to establish that, I think he's accomplishing two things at once. He's still trying to establish that his understanding of the gospel lined up with the apostles, namely, in this passage, with Peter. And the way he gets at it is he describes an account where he rebuked Peter, but if we look at his rebuke, he rebukes Peter on the ground of what Peter and Paul agree on. Peter, we both know this. We both understand this. We both view the gospel this way. And therefore, what are you doing, Peter? We'll explain that as we go on. But the purpose it serves in the book of Galatians, the first purpose it serves, is to suggest to his readers, so don't you see, Peter and I are completely on the same page in this matter. The second thing he does is, for the first time now in Galatians, he addresses the issue, and the reason by pointing out What's amiss? What's wrong? What's faulty about his opponents in Galatia and their understanding of the gospel? And he's doing that by pointing out what's faulty in the view of that same group of people in Antioch as he is addressing Peter. That'll become clear when we get a better picture of the scenario. But suffice it to say for now, he's making the point that his understanding is in agreement with the apostles, and secondly, we're getting a first glimpse of what his understanding is in contradistinction to that of his opponents. How do they differ? And he's going to explain that by way of a remark he makes to Peter. So let's look at this section. Hopefully you got the updated version of the second installment, which will include this section. This will be in 2:11 if you're following in your regular translations, or paragraph 10 in my translation. Remember, Cephas is the same as Peter, same person. Now when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was in the wrong. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and separate himself, fearing the ones from among the circumcision. The rest of the Jews also played the part with him, with the result that even Barnabas joined them in their play acting, in this play acting. But when I saw that they were not behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, "If you, being a Jew, can live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how are you pressuring Gentiles to live like Jews? We are Jews by nature and not sinners from among the Gentiles, and yet knowing that a man is not decreed to chaos on the basis of his works of Torah, except in view of our belief regarding Jesus the Messiah, even we have believed in Messiah Jesus, with the result that we are decreed to chaos by reason of our belief in the Messiah and not by reason of our works of Torah. Because on the basis of works of Torah, no natural-born human will ever be decreed to chaos. But if, while seeking to be decreed to chaos in the Messiah, even we ourselves have been found sinners, is the Messiah then a servant of sin? May it never be. Indeed, if I again rebuild these things that I have previously destroyed, then I constitute myself a transgressor. Now, through my efforts to obey the Mosaic covenant, I died by that covenant, with the result that I stand to live by God. I have been crucified with the Messiah, and no longer do I think I stand to live. Yet, to my benefit, the Messiah lives, and by reason of this, I now stand to live in the midst of my present physical existence. Because of my belief, I stand to live on the basis of the Son of God, the one who loved me and gave himself up on my behalf. I do not reject the gift of God. Indeed, if dikaiosune is through the covenant, then the Messiah died for no reason." Okay. If you happen to have the handout that you got in the first week, you'll notice that in item number 17, Paul returns to Antioch and reports on his journey, so that in about 46 or 47 AD, Paul returns from the very journey where he established these churches that this letter is written to. He returns from that journey to Antioch in Syria. Then in the next year, about 48 AD, Jewish believers from Jerusalem come to Antioch. They come from Jerusalem up to Antioch in Syria. They precipitate an energetic dispute with Paul and Barnabas over whether Gentile Jewish believers need to live like Jews, the very issue that Galatians is talking about. Now, that's in Acts. We have it recorded in Acts that these Jews from Jerusalem came to Antioch and Barnabas and Paul got in a big dispute with them, and this was the issue, okay? It's during that dispute, I would argue, so in about 48, where after his first missionary journey to Galatia, but before the Acts 15 council, During that dispute that Barnabas and Paul are having with the people from Jerusalem, during the dispute between Paul and the Jewish believers from Jerusalem, Paul rebukes Peter for his choices and behavior, accusing him of not being straightforward about the implications of the gospel. That's what he's talking about in this section. Sometime in the middle of that, or just after that, but somehow roughly the same contemporaneous with those disputes, some of those Jews make their way up to the churches in Galatia. It may very well be that their going to Galatia is precipitated by going to Antioch, hearing about what Paul did up in Galatia, being in the middle of this dispute with Paul, and realize, we got to go set them straight because they're believing what Paul is believing. So they might have very well left Antioch to go up to Galatia to set the churches straight up there. And those are the people that are disturbing them, the churches in Galatia, and Paul hears of that, and that prompts him to write this letter. That's in the next year or so, in 21. And then later in the next year, in 49, is when they decide this is really a big deal. We have to get this straightened out. And they go to Jerusalem again now, and they have the famous Acts 15 council, where the apostles and elders sorted out together with Paul, and they come to an official and formal decision that Paul's right. Paul is right on all of these issues. So that's what Paul's talking about in this section, is that visit from the Jews in Jerusalem to Antioch, where they got in a big argument with Paul and Barnabas. So now when Cephas came to Antioch, Peter had come prior to those Jews coming from Antioch, those other Jews coming from Jerusalem. Paul had already come to Antioch and was spending time now. When he first came to Antioch, when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was in the wrong. Okay, let me get this out of the way right away. Paul is not accusing Peter of having his doctrine or his theology wrong. He appeals to him on the basis that they believe exactly the same theology and hold to exactly the same doctrine. So he's never anywhere in here accusing him of not understanding the gospel. They're on the same page. We know they're on the same page because remember that earlier visit to Jerusalem, where he brought famine relief and he got together with Peter, Cephas, James, and John and privately shared his understanding of the gospel with them, and they decided that they were absolutely on the same page. What Peter really actually believes was in agreement with what Paul teaches. And it's been that way for some time. And Paul knows that he believes that because he's checked it out with him in that earlier visit. That was what we looked at last week. That's what he describes in Galatians in the paragraph last week. Okay. So what is he wrong about if he shares the same doctrines and the same beliefs and the same theology? What he was wrong about is the action that he took, the choice that he made. And we'll go on and see what that choice was here as we go on here. Why was he in the wrong? For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, what he calls them here, men from James. But when these men from James came, he began to withdraw and separate himself, fearing the ones from among the circumcision. What was Peter's wrong? He began to withdraw after the men from James came. And that's what Paul is rebuking him for. He's rebuking him for making the choice to stop eating with the Gentiles. Okay, a couple of details. Let's get the picture right here. Who are these certain men from James? It's easy to read into that they have some kind of an official status as representatives of James, and therefore that they are representing the understanding of James himself. That's not necessarily the case, and I, I think it's clearly not the case here, because James was one of those people who agreed with Paul and extended to him the right hand of koinonia during his famine visit to Jerusalem. So James is on the same page as Paul as well. James would not agree with these certain men from James that have come up to Antioch. Well, why are they certain men from James then? I think in much the same way that if someone stood up here today and said, I'm from Rick Warren's church, or I'm from, that's the extent of my knowledge of Christian culture, somebody Stanley's church, or I'm from, think of some famous evangelical or otherwise Christian out there who's relatively well known, and they sure enough go to, I'm from John MacArthur's church. They sure enough go to John MacArthur's church, but are they on, do they agree with John MacArthur? Do they even understand John MacArthur? Do they represent the teaching of John MacArthur faithfully in the way that they come into our midst and interact with us? Well, that's another question, right? They may or may not. And I'm almost confident I can say that there are people who have gone elsewhere around the world and said, well, I went to Jack Crabtree's Bible study. Okay. But when they open their mouth to talk about the gospel, are they representing what Jack Crabtree believes about the gospel? Well, not necessarily. It depends on whether they understood Jack, whether they really understood it. And we're going to see here how subtle the error is. The error that's being made is incredibly subtle, and it's an error that's easy to make. And you can think you're on the same page as someone else and be miles apart from them. So we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that because these men are from James, they are faithfully and fairly representing how James would have interacted in Antioch in exactly the same circumstances. So it's pretty clear that these certain men from James are taking the same position that the opponents in Galatia are taking. I think they're some of the same people, might even be some of the same individuals. They're some of the people who, from the very beginning, they're the people who, when Peter came back after Cornelius was preached the gospel to, and the Spirit came upon Cornelius, and Peter came back to Jerusalem and reported it, and he got flack from all these people. I think Acts says from the Pharisees, of the sect of the Pharisees. He caught flack from them. Why did he catch flack from them? You went into the house of a Gentile and ate with a Gentile? What are you doing, Peter? And Peter has to defend himself by saying, God told me to. I had a vision and I didn't really have a choice. I mean, that's why I did that. And they kind of backed off at that point, but they were opposing him even then. So there's been this stream within the community in Jerusalem from the very beginning, this pressure to have this mindset that I've talked about, where to be righteous, you have to do what God said, right? Yet you should live a life that looks like God says righteousness looks like. And where do you go for that picture? Go to the law. So you have to keep the law, obey the law to live the righteousness that Jesus encouraged us to pursue. So real disciples are going to keep the law. That's the position that they're taking. So they come into town, Antioch, and they find Paul and Peter and Barnabas and a bunch of other Jews in Antioch surrounded by a bunch of believing Gentiles, and they're mixing. They're socializing with each other. They're going to one another's houses and dining together. Well, that goes against the Jewish tradition. And these men from James look at that happening and they go, oh my goodness, look at the moral laxity that's being practiced by these so-called Jesus followers of Jesus here in Antioch. And they're having a cow over what it is that they're seeing. and they are undoubtedly scolding and censuring and clearly holding in contempt their fellow Jews like Peter and Barnabas and Paul, who are exercising the freedom to dine in the homes of Gentiles. They're holding them in contempt and censuring them and scorning them. So what does Peter do? He withdraws. Now, the question we have to ask is, why did Peter do that? What is he thinking, and what's his motivation? And I think we have to make a distinction between what is really happening, at least from Paul's perspective, as he tells us what he thinks is happening. But I think we also need to ask the question, what does Peter think he's doing? Because I don't think they're the same thing. We'll talk about that. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he began to withdraw and separate himself, fearing the ones from among the circumcision. Now, what Paul is saying is the real reason is that Peter got intimidated. And he got intimidated into not practicing what I would practice, which is to continue eating with the Gentiles. I want to park on that and say several things about that. I'll come back to that. To finish the paragraph, the rest of the Jews also played the part with him, with Cephas, with the result that even Barnabas joined with them in this play acting. We have to talk about why is it play acting here. But when I saw that they were not behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel, remember that now. So what is his concern? What was Peter wrong about? He wasn't behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel. It was the truth of the gospel that was at stake, and Peter had made the wrong choice with respect to the truth of the gospel. We need to understand that. We'll talk about that. And then in light of that, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, and then we have his rebuke, his remark. Okay, let me first talk about how I think Peter rationalized his action. Because I think it would be very easy to rationalize his action. But from Paul's perspective, it was just a rationalization. It wasn't the real issue and the real motivation. It would be easy to, if you're in Peter's shoes, here are these people making a lot of noise about how they believe that Jews certainly should not be eating with Gentiles. In fact, really, their doctrine and their position is the Gentiles should start living like Jews so that everybody is eating kosher together and being clean together and ritually clean together and so on. So they would have all those Gentiles basically become Jews. And that's how they would solve the problem. So the fact that Paul is content to let a Gentile remain a Gentile, and not only content to let him remain a Gentile, but to associate with him, dine with him, socialize with him, that's just crazy as far as they're concerned. Well, they're making a lot of noise about that. And there's a whole lot of scorn and contempt coming Peter's way from this group of people. Peter could easily tell himself, well, they just don't understand. Their understanding is immature. They don't understand the freedom that we have in Christ the way Paul and I do and Barnabas does. And we're not going to make any headway with them and not going to be able to explain the freedom that we have in Christ if we just sort of make choices that fly in the face of their objections, their hang-ups about this. We need to make ourselves subject to their conscience. We need to make ourselves bow to their view in order to win them, in order that we not lose their hearing, in order that we keep the lines of communication open. And over time, we can talk about this, and they can come to understand, as we do, the freedom that we have in Christ. Sound familiar? That's exactly the advice that Paul gives to the Romans in Romans 14. You who are strong, don't exercise the freedom that your superior understanding gives you if you're going to harm the weaker brother, if you're going to put a stumbling block in his path. By all means, love the weaker brother, and that means foregoing whatever freedom and whatever rights and whatever you know you can by all rights do and practice. Set it aside and don't do it and don't practice it if it's going to be a stumbling block to the weaker brother. He spends, three, four chapters in 1 Corinthians saying exactly the same thing. So why does Paul have a problem with Peter taking Paul's advice? Right? That's what Paul counsels everybody else to do. Why does he have a problem when Peter seemingly takes his counsel elsewhere and does what Paul thinks is the loving thing to do, to serve other people? Well, in Romans and in 1 Corinthians, the truth of the gospel is not at stake. So remember the context here. There is a flaming, raging controversy going on, and everybody knows about it. It's this public feud, this public dispute between Paul and Barnabas on the one hand and these men from James, certain men from James on the other hand, and they're having these heated arguments that undoubtedly are known to the larger community. So the issue is, who's right? Right? That's the issue on everybody's mind. Who's right? Paul and Barnabas or these men from James? Paul recognizes that Peter, if you back off and start behaving the way they want you to, how do you think everybody in Antioch is going to interpret your action? They're going to see that as you casting a vote in their favor. Your actions are pretending like you agree with them. And I know, Peter, that you don't agree with them. You're just play acting. This is just pretense. You're pretending to go along with them, but you don't really. So why would you allow your pretense to be construed as a vote in favor of their gospel over the gospel that you and I know is true? Why would you do that? That's why he says, I saw that they were not behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel. Okay? Now, Paul thinks that what's really going on, Why the pretense? Why the play acting? Because scorn and contempt is incredibly, incredibly intimidating and very powerful and compelling. And Paul's reading is Peter got intimidated into getting the heat off of him by going along. If the only way to avoid your scorn and your contempt is to kind of go along and act the way you want me to, then so be it. I'll get myself out of the crosshairs by taking this action. I don't really believe it. I don't really believe that you understand the gospel rightly, but I will act like I do if that's going to get the heat off of me. And that's what Paul thinks is really going on. It was so intense, he says, that even Barnabas joined with them in this play acting. And remember in Acts, Barnabas was a partisan with Paul in the disputes with these people. At the doctrinal level, at the level of beliefs, Barnabas and Paul together are in joint dispute with these men. But somehow it got so heated and so the pressure on them was so great that even Barnabas took the same step that Peter did. And it was Paul and Paul alone, apparently, who was maintaining his ground and saying, for the sake of the gospel, there's no way in the world that I'm going to resist practicing what we've been practicing for months. We're going to socialize with Gentiles because we're free to do so. There's nothing wrong with me as a Jew socializing with a Gentile, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to keep doing it. Now, in another situation, Paul may very well not do it. If he thought he could win some Jews by not practicing that freedom, he may very well choose not to socialize with Gentiles in a certain context, in a certain place. But it wouldn't be a context where a controversy was raging, and the very controversy was, what's the truth of the gospel and what are its implications? In that context, he would dare not do it. The truth is too important. I want to park on that just a little bit before we, and then I'll open it up to your questions. Where does the contempt come from? Where does the scorn come from? Why would these men from James hold Paul in such contempt for acting the way he did and behaving the way he did? There's a difference between mercy and mushiness. You know, mercy is to recognize that someone is wrong, disobedient, unrighteous, sinful, ungodly, whatever. To recognize the wrongness of their lifestyle, their choices, their decisions, their attitude, whatever. But not holding it against them. And why do you not hold it against them? Well, we're all wrong. I'm just as wrong as they are in many ways. So I'm no perfect human being. If I'm going to hold their imperfection against, if I don't want anybody to hold my imperfection against me, then I dare not hold their imperfection against them. That's the mercy that all of us as followers of Jesus are called to. It's the one who grants mercy who's going to receive mercy. And if we will not grant mercy to other people, then we're not going to receive mercy from God. That's a theme in Jesus' teaching. So receiving the mercy of God, that is accepting the fact that God is going to grant me a blessing that I do not deserve, recognizing that that's where I stand means that I'm going to have that same kind of attitude toward other people. It's okay with me if you get the good that you do not deserve, the benefit that you do not deserve, that I treat you with the goodness that you may not even deserve, but I'm going to treat you with that goodness anyway. That's mercy. That mushiness is looking at the disobedience and sin and evil and wickedness and ungodliness of other people and going, oh, well, yeah, whatever. No big deal. I'll just accept them anyway because it's not a big deal, because unrighteousness is really not that big a deal. Mercy recognizes that unrighteousness is a huge big deal. It's absolutely a big deal. But the profundity of God's mercy is that he's going to let it go and grant us the blessing we don't deserve anyway. Mushiness has decided to not punish people for their evil by telling ourselves the story that unrighteousness is not that big a deal. Those are radically different attitudes, fundamentally different attitudes. But someone who doesn't understand mercy, and you know, even if we understand it conceptually, to really, truly, from the depth of my being, understand it, it's not common that people understand mercy. It's actually relatively rare. And a person who does not understand mercy, mercy is always going to appear to them as mushiness. You just don't think righteousness and obedience is important. So that's how the men from James are looking at Paul. Paul, these Gentiles are violating the law of Moses. You don't think that's a big deal? No. Well, okay. That's where this whole issue gets complicated, because that's true. The particular issues of Sabbath keeping and dietary regulations and so on, they are not ultimately a big deal, and Paul would maintain that that's the case. But Paul would take the same attitude towards someone who was a thief or an adulterer or a murderer or whatever. It could be a heinous crime, but he could still tolerate the crime in another person out of mercy, in the right kind of context, in the right situation. Someone who doesn't understand mercy is going to look at Paul and go, "Paul, what are you doing? That is an absolutely heinous crime." To which he would say, "Yeah, it is. I'm a murderer too. I got all kinds of people killed. And you want me to list all the things that I've done wrong as well? And why do I stand expecting to inherit life from God? By his incredibly deep and profound mercy. That's why. And if God can show mercy to me, then he can show mercy to my brother over here who's guilty of this heinous crime." Doesn't mean the crime wasn't heinous. Of course it was heinous. But God's mercy is greater still. Okay. Well, in the minds of these people from James, mushiness deserves censure. And they're right. It deserves to be censured. If someone is not taking disobedience and ungodliness and sin seriously enough, they deserve to be rebuked. What are you doing? That's terrible that you would downplay and underplay the heinousness and the travesty of unrighteousness. So they're going to look at a person like Paul, and they're going to be very censorious toward him or toward Peter, as they apparently were. But why are they censorious toward him? Because they're unable to make the distinction between mercy toward unrighteousness and mushiness toward unrighteousness. They're not only are they not making the distinction, I dare say they're incapable of seeing the difference. And so it all collapses into mushiness for them. I think it's worth thinking about the danger of making exactly the opposite mistake that Peter made in our time and place and culture. We're not likely to make Peter's mistake, but we are likely to make the opposite mistake. Today, the one who has not understood and embraced the importance and the significance and the value of obedience and righteousness, they respond in scorn and contempt to someone who does demand, who does respect the demands of righteousness, especially the demands of righteousness on every human being, because we recognize that every human being is subject to the demands of God's righteousness. If you and I respect those demands, not only on ourselves, but on everyone else out there, you know what our society is going to think of you. They're going to look at you with scorn and contempt. You're a hater. That's what you are. You're a hater. The one who does not understand obedience, and just like there are a lot of people who don't understand mercy, I think there are a lot of people who don't understand obedience. At least they don't understand its value. They don't understand its significance. They don't understand its importance. Anyone who doesn't understand obedience in that way, mushiness is always defended as mercy. So, you know, their way of dealing with people is, you know, people are doing things that you call disobedient. Yeah, okay, yeah. Their real attitude is, oh well, it's not that big a deal, it's not that important. But how would they defend their moral laxity? Well, I'm just being merciful. And didn't Jesus call us to be merciful? Didn't he call us to forgive? Didn't he call us to be loving? But that's to take what in fact is mushiness and baptize it as mercy in order to rationalize it and excuse it. So that person is going to be censorious toward somebody who respects the demands of righteousness and obedience. And you and I, at least from a distance, have felt the heat of that as more and more people who respect the demands of righteousness are accused of hatred. You are a hater. But where's that judgment you are a hater coming from? Because they have the inability, and I think it literally is an inability, to distinguish between a lack of mercy toward others and and mushiness. I didn't finish my sentence in my notes. And a lack of mercy and mushiness. They can't tell the difference. They don't know the difference. So in the current climate, we could easily find ourselves in exactly the same kind of situation that Peter was in, where the pressure on us is, don't you dare pass judgment, make a moral judgment, make a moral assertion about the rightness or wrongness of what these other people are doing here. Don't you dare do that. If you are, you're a hater, and will be blamed and censured and called all kinds of mean, nasty names. The temptation is going to want to be to deflect the heat and to pretend that I agree with them by my actions, when in the quietness of my mind and heart, I don't agree with them at all. Now, in the wider and broader context of our culture, I don't think Paul would expect us to, you know, to take a stand against non-Christians. But what about in the church? You know, what about in situations where people are claiming to be fellow believers and they become the conduit of the heat? You hater, you're just bigoted and self-righteousness and superior and all these mean, nasty things. And, you know, you're going to back off. Oh, okay, yeah. No, I'm going to shut my mouth. I won't say anything. I'll let it stand. Well, I think Paul would say that would rebuke us in exactly the same way he did Peter. You're not being straightforward about the truth of the gospel. The truth of the gospel is at stake. So you're not acting rightly if you allow yourself to be silenced and shut up when the situation demands that you speak boldly the truth. Let me pause there for any questions or comments.
Backing up a little bit, when you said Paul, see if I can get this, he was concerned about the believing Jews in Antioch, that because they were already saying that they were believers in Jesus the Messiah. And that's why he felt like...
You said Paul. Did you mean Paul or Peter?
Paul. He was concerned that they didn't have the gospel straight because they actually said they were believers in Jesus. Whereas if he was trying to win a Jew that was not a believer, then he might not eat with Gentiles because the offense might keep them away from the gospel. I mean, is that... You mentioned something like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's essentially. The fact that the believing Jews didn't have the gospel right that he was concerned. if he was trying to win a Jew that did not believe in Jesus, he might have taken a different stance.
Well, I think he's more concerned about the Gentiles in Antioch than the Jews.
Okay.
Because, you know, Paul and other believing Jews have come in, have proclaimed the message about Jesus. They've believed it. Paul has sorted out, in conjunction with these other people, they've sorted out together, is it okay, can Gentiles actually be followers of Jesus mm-hmm. without living like Jews? Yeah, they can. They can be followers of Jesus and still be Gentiles. And they've worked that out, and they've come to a... They've kind of created a state in the community where they just accept one another and socialize with one another. They emphasize their commonality as followers of Jesus and are not bothered by their differences as Jew and Gentile. That seems to be the situation that they've established. Now these other Jews are coming along, and basically what they're maintaining is you've been misled by Paul and his ilk. They have misled you. So the Gentiles are basically being confronted by a different version of the gospel. That's clearly what's going on in Galatians. They're being confronted by a different version of the gospel, and it proves to be a little confusing to them. So who's right? Which one is right? I mean, you're from James? I mean, James, the brother of Jesus? I mean, maybe we're not really on the right path here. And what Paul is concerned about is them being confused and them being discombobulated by this thing. It could potentially affect believing Jews as well, believing Jews who have maybe not are as strong in their understanding and conviction as Paul is, and therefore, you know, they could be knocked off the truth of the gospel and persuaded to join these certain men from James in their perspective, and he would be just as concerned about them as well, I think. Paul, the weaker brother issue, there are no formulas, I don't think. The most important thing is to understand what Paul is going after in Romans 14 and in 1 Corinthians. What he's going after is that you read the situation, and as best you understand the situation, you assess what is going to be the likely impact of my actions on a certain group of people. If the impact on them is harmful, then you going right ahead with that behavior is kind of unloving, isn't it? In different contexts, what you actually end up doing might be different, as is the case here. This is such a different context, because the greatest harm to people is going to come by confusing the gospel message. And so that's way more important to him in this context than that somebody doesn't get their feathers bent out of shape.
So if I understood you correctly, you're saying that it's particularly in the church that it's important to guard against that mushiness.
Well, I don't want to say exclusively so, but in order to draw a parallel here, mm-hmm. what's happening here is within the community of believers. Mm-hmm. Would Paul have said the same thing about the wider community of all of Antioch? I kind of doubt it, because to expect pagans to be unclear about the gospel. Yeah, it's only when they get interested enough to come inside and be being taught the gospel that it becomes important that we tell it straight and get it right.
So what would that look like? How are you thinking about
in
that?
In our circumstance?
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about this. It's a really difficult issue. I mean, especially if you think about this particular church, who's a member of this church?
Mm-hmm.
Who's a part of us?
Mm-hmm.
That's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, well, okay, let's say that one, two, or three really loud voices came in, and maybe they were a part of a movement to enter into churches and push them in the direction of social justice and with all of its implications.
This would be a really strategic place to do that.
Yeah. I didn't say they were smart. you could easily see with the kind of passion and energy and intimidation and all that kind of stuff that many of us would feel the need to just kind of back off and, okay. Yeah, Jesus wanted us to love one another, and I don't know that we would, but I think there are plenty of churches out there where that's exactly what would happen. There's whole denominations where that's what's happening, right? There's whole denominations where they've been intimidated by the culture into giving way to other voices that are in the name of love and mercy and tolerance and all kinds of stuff, are actually saying, let's kind of wink at unrighteousness and perversion and stuff that's not true and not good. And they capitulate. Well, what's the right thing to do? I mean, several people here faced exactly that issue, and they chose to speak up against it. It wasn't easy to do. They lost a lot of friends to do that, but they chose to speak up against it. Most of the people in the church apparently chose to kind of capitulate. Yeah, whatever. So that's the kind of thing I have in mind. I'm not really all that worried about us for a variety of reasons. But there may be circumstances in our workplace where that comes up, not within the church, but in the workplace. Not that we want to necessarily change the culture, but maybe we're in a workplace where the truth of the gospel to other believers is now having to be maintained. I need to stand up for the truth of the gospel so that these other believers who are getting confused are not confused about that. And that may require that I speak out. And I speak my mind. And I need to be hateful.
In that situation, capitulation would be mushiness.
Would be much what?
In that situation, capitulation would be mushiness.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
So with that specific example, what are you claiming is at stake? If I were in a workplace and I didn't speak out, is my own personal salvation at stake? What's at stake?
The truth of the gospel is at stake. Mm-hmm. So it's other people. See, I don't think Paul never once is calling into question Peter's salvation or his faith or his loyalty, anything like that. What he's calling into question is, Peter, you made a really, really wrong choice here. The impact on other people is outrageous. You're not behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel, and you may understand the truth of the gospel, but those guys are confused, and you're not keeping it clear in their minds. You're not making it clear what the gospel is.
So what's at stake is other people's salvation, perhaps.
Yeah.
And my cowardice is this thing that's standing in the way of that happening.
Capitulation in the workplace is a problem with their salvation, not my salvation.
I think so.
And if it's a pagan organization versus Christian friends, is there a difference? Can I act differently in a circumstance at a workplace where Christianity is not an issue? Am I there to challenge a pagan because of their mushiness?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Try to tackle it with Catherine's question. She was asking, is it wrong that I act with capitulation in the workplace? Whose problem is that? Will I be offending my salvation, or will I not take the opportunity to assist in a pagan's salvation?
Well, see, that's what I was getting at in answer to Jan about what Paul teaches about the weaker brother and everything. To turn it into a formula is to misunderstand what he's doing and what he's saying. We have to read each situation differently. Who are the players? What's the state of mind of the players? What is their understanding of things? What do they, what don't they understand? It's by understanding all of that as best I can, and then trying to understand what is my action, what I say or what I do, what impact is that going to have on these players? And then if I assess that the impact on them might really be harmful to them because it's going to prevent them from coming to an understanding of the truth of the gospel, then don't do it if that action is going to do that. Or if my inaction is going to do that, then don't bite your tongue if their salvation is at stake and the truth of the gospel that is the story of their salvation is at stake. Then don't bite your tongue if you can clarify it for them. So what I'm saying is I need to know who the players are before I can answer the question and what their state of mind is and what they're thinking. But I think that's in both Romans and 1 Corinthians. That's what he's doing, is the principle is let love for others, always trump your freedom. Don't just go out and decide you're free to do something and just leave it at that and go practice your freedom and exercise your freedom. Worry about what the cost is in the lives of other people. And if you assess that there will be a cost, then don't exercise your freedom. Are we free to be silent and not make waves at times? Yeah. Yeah, we're free. But not if someone's soul is at stake.
That's a good clarification to the answering Catherine. Assess the situation, I think, is what I learned from your from your answer.
Yeah. I don't know how many of you read about the women's soccer player. She was not put on the national team, allegedly because she wasn't good enough. But the people who know her apparently are dubious about that because she's a pretty good soccer player. She's an awfully good soccer player. Her not making the team followed on the heels of the women's team playing in a game where they were going to wear rainbow-colored numbers, was that it? In honor of all things, what do I call it? LGBTQ, LMNOP, that all things that, in honor of all of that, they were changing something about their uniform. And she asked permission to not wear that uniform and just wear their normal uniform instead. She got accused of bigotry, hatred, so on and so forth and so forth. And lo and behold, she didn't make the team. Now, coincidence or, I mean, because the claim is she just wasn't good enough. But if you know enough about the women's soccer team, in all likelihood, she probably was booted because she took a stand. Now, that's not just the church necessarily, although, you know, there are a whole lot of people, Jesus followers out there in the world who are soccer fans, believe it or not. They really are Jesus-believing soccer fans. And they're watching, you know, they're looking. They're paying attention. So was her calculation that I am making a mockery of everything I believe as a follower of Jesus if I am a hypocrite and go along and act like I agree with them when I really don't? I mean, all I know is I have nothing but an incredible amount of respect for, I mean, everything. And the thing is, she's not bitter. I mean, if you hear her, the interview, she's not bitter that she didn't get picked. And what a World Cup to not get picked for. I mean, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. Well, okay. Eric Little was willing to give up a gold medal because he didn't quite understand the freedom that we have in Christ. But those are heroic acts. So, you know, the more of those that Christians can make, the more we are behaving rightly in relation to the truth of the gospel, I think.
Just a couple of things. I'm not sure if I could even teach in the Eugene School District anymore and hold a job. I mean, I might get hired if I didn't have to answer truthfully to some questions maybe, but I've been wondering about that. I don't know, it's changed so much even in the 20 years since I've been teaching that I'm just not sure. I don't think I could, I mean, I would have to be so careful of what I said, not only to fellow colleagues, but also to students and stuff. I don't even know if I could make it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, just as a comment, Sports Illustrated came out. The cover of the Sports Illustrated magazine today has the soccer player. What's her name?
Rapinoe.
Yeah, who's an outspoken gay person. Mm-hmm. Surrounded by and holding hands with girls that are like elementary school age girls. And so that's, and you can say what you want about it, but I mean, this is what we're holding up as models and something to be looked up to. And it's just kind of amazing to me. That's always been how people want to live their lives as their business, but to honor those that are so opposed and hold them up is just it's hard for me to handle.
And to point our finger and accuse you of being a bigot and a hater for even objecting.
Yeah,
to that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is we were talking about, well, we just got back from Cannon Beach and the two speakers there, one was Josh White and the other one was Rick McKinley, but those are two pastors from the Portland area that are in the southeast side or something. I mean, down in the hardcore Portland areas where it's almost impossible to start a church and stuff. But he said that we have to walk the tightrope all the time of how do you hold up the truth of the gospel and still invite the people that we're reaching out to, because he says, and then they had all kinds of things to say about, just Portland. And he says, about Portland, just the city of Portland, the attitudes of the Portland and what, and he says, and then you take that and you can magnify it, 10 times on the people that they are dealing with. And so they just are inviting people into their church, and they even gave a few examples of some situations that they were dealing with where even the people that were listening to them, we all didn't agree with what they had done, but that's, they were reaching out and trying to encourage people to come, because if they don't come, they can't hear. And then the next part is, well, here, now you got all these people that, how do you stay true to the gospel and what you're saying? And
well, I need to let you go, but so just to sum up and be clear then about what Paul is talking about, we didn't get to what he said to Peter. It's a very powerful statement, and we'll take next week to look at that. But Peter has been socializing with Gentiles, just like Paul and everybody else. These men from James come, they wag their finger at Peter, he gets intimidated, he rationalizes it with probably a very good rationalization, but he gets intimidated into hiding the fact that he actually agrees with Paul, and he behaves in a manner as if he doesn't, thereby casting a vote for this other gospel. that is being propagated by the certain men from James rather than the gospel that Paul received from God. So that's what he has said so far, and then he's going to tell us, we'll look at it next week, what it is he said to Peter. And that's very revealing because it's the contrast between what Paul believes and what he thinks are the implications of what his opponents believe. We'll do that next week.